Chapter 22. The Cronus Club is power. Make no mistake, for that is what it is. Laziness, apathy, and a lack of interest, these are what restrain the exercise of its resources. Fear, too, perhaps. Fear of what has been and what will come. It is not entirely true to say that we who are Kalachakra can live our life free of consequence. I killed myself in my fourth life to escape Fearson and his tape machine, and in my fifth I did indeed seek the counselling that Virginia had suggested. I do not regain consciousness all at once. There is no one flash of memory being restored, but rather it is a gradual recollection that begins at my third birthday and is complete by my fourth. Harriet said I cried a lot in the early years of my fifth life. She said she had never seen such a sad infant. I realize now that, in a way, the process of recalling my previous death was almost a natural working through of it, a reliving step by step as my mind integrated it into who I was. I sought counseling, as I said. Virginia was correct that the medical services would hardly do, and our chaplain, as established, was of very little use. By the time I remembered what I was and where I had come from, I could see the beginning of Harriet's decline and read the gaunt recognition in Patrick's face as his wife began to wither before his eyes. Cancer is a process on which the healthy cannot impose. I was a child and could not express myself to these two people who, in my own slow way, I had come to love. I needed the help of a stranger, needed the means to express myself to someone else. I wrote to my father. He may seem an unlikely choice, an unusual confidant. Needless to say, I could not tell him all. There would be no reference to my true nature, no telling of the future past, or mention of my age. Rather, I penned my letters in a stiff adult's hand, signing myself Private Harry Brooks, late of my father's division. I wrote it as an apology, as a confession. Told him that he would not remember me, but that I remembered him, hoping for his understanding, his attentive ear. I told him of being captured by the enemy in the First World War, making up the details of my arrest from the books I had read and tales I had heard. I told him of being interrogated, and here I wrote it out in full. The beatings and the pain, the humiliations and the loss, the delirium and the drugs, and the moment I tried to make it end. Over several months and many letters, I told him everything, adapting only the names and times to suit my confessional and transforming my successful suicide attempt into merely suicide attempted. "Forgive me," I wrote at the bottom. "I did not think I would break." He didn't reply for a very long time. I had given him an entirely fictional address to send his response to, knowing full well that I would be the boy sent with the mail to the post office. Private Harry Brooks poured his heart out to a distant stranger who made no reply. But I knew that what I needed was not so much the comfort of return, but to speak of what I had been. The telling was all, the reply merely a courtesy. Yet I longed for it with a childish passion that I could not fully attribute to my hormones and physical biology. I began to grow angry in my father's presence, knowing that he had received the letters of Private Brooks and read them, and marvelling that he did not weep and could maintain such a carapace of stone in the face of my genuine anguish. My fury must have been visible briefly on my face, for my grandmother spoke to Harriet and exclaimed, "That boy of yours is a vile little wretch. He gives us such terrible looks." Harriet chided me, but she, more than any other, I think, could sense the thing beneath the surface which I was trying to express and dared not say out loud. Even Patrick, not averse to the willow wand, seemed to beat me less in that life for my transgressions, and my cousin Clement, usually the bully of the household, hid from me in the house. Then at last my father replied. I stole the letter off its silver plate by the door before any in the household could see, and ran to the woods to read it. His handwriting, infuriatingly, was a lot like mine. How insufferable, I concluded, to have inherited so many genetic traits from this overindulged man. Then I read, and my anger diminished. Dear Private H. Brooks, I have received and read your letters with interest, and cordially thank you for your courage and fortitude in both enduring what you have endured and expressing the truth of it to your superiors. Please know that I bear you no ill will for anything you may have expressed to the enemy, for no one could have suffered what you suffered and been less the man. I commend you, sir, and I salute you. We have seen things that men cannot name. We have learned, you and I, to speak a language of bloodshed and violence. Words do not reach deep enough. Music is no more than hollow sound. The smiles of strangers grow false. We must speak, and dare not, cannot, unless it is in mud and the screams of men. We have no kin but each other, for our loves to our mothers and our wives demand that we protect them from what we know. Ours is the fellowship of strangers who know a secret that we cannot express. We are both of us broken, shattered, hollow and alone. Only for the ones we love do we remain, painted dolls in the playhouse of this life. In them we must find our meaning. In them we must hold to hope. I trust you find the one who gives you this meaning, and remain always your sincere friend, Major R. E. Hune. I burned the letter after reading it, and scattered its ashes beneath the trees. Private Harry Brooks did not write to my father again.